So I'm going to talk about basically three loosely related calculations, three subjects, which compare perturbation theory to string field theory calculation in the SO6 sector. Then I'm going to compare a conjecture, which basically extends the integrability assisted calculation towards the SO6, compare it with stringy calculation. And then I look once more into the one loop integrability formula for three-point functions, and we'll try to see if it can be related to string theory. If not, what the possible reason of a discrepancy may be. I know there are some, I think, of the world's top experts in the audience, yet I will start talking perhaps even the basic things through, so that we're sure that we all speak the same language. So basically, why be interested in the three-point correlation functions in n equals 4 Supermans? So some people believe that, well, there are very few problems that still remain to be solved. And this is to some extent true, that, well, as someone says, it's a rather boring theory, since we know everything about the spectrum already, both the weak and the strong strong coupling, thanks to the beta Ansatz equations. So we know basically everything about the two-point correlation functions. Yet three-point functions are still a challenge, since there are for sure sectors in where there is just no explicit, or there is just no exact expression for these objects. So first of all, of course, I mean the strongly coupled case, and the case when you have very highly excited string states, or which in the language of operators correspond to the so-called heavy operators. So there is a variety of semi-classical methods, which I'm not going to talk about here. Sometimes they really do yield very beautiful things, yet we are not in possession of, for example, an all loop result, either for the weakly coupled side, where only a one loop formula for a three-point function is available from the integrable from the integrability assisted resummation up to now. And we're also limited to the leading order in the case of semi-classics. So there is a vast space of research which still can be done about three-point functions. And here I'm trying to explore it from three different corners and see if though they match or not. So, as I said, I'll present here basically three instances, three examples of a computation of for one and the same object done on two different sides, just to anticipate the results. Let me point out already here that In part one and part two, I'll be happy to demonstrate something like a beautiful equality, or at least a reasonable guess. And in case three, there will be actually rather a question posed at the end of this third section, rather than some definite answer given, since here are some discrepancy is still being observed at the next leading order between these two different ways of calculating one and the same object. So, basically, what are the motivations to look for the three-point functions on different sides of the duality? Well, one of them is has been, for example, the work I cite here by Bissi, Harmack, and Arcelli, who have noticed that, for example, one of the possible sectors which are feasible now, the heavy light, is indeed yielding a discrepancy in the next in the next leading order. So therefore, it's very important to, let's say, to gather some experimental evidence if the correspondence is true or not. And then, when we have enough evidence, we can pose deeper questions. If, for example, the operator definitions on string side, integrability side, and perturbative gauge theory side do really satisfy us in terms of describing the same object, or if we are quite and completely happy with the duality conjecture itself. So the three basic methods I'm going to be using here are mentioned on this slide. So the field theory calculation is very down to earth, perturbative super Young-Mills count, which has been known for more than a decade. The beta ansatz calculation has been supposed by several people in the audience, in particular, and by Kolya Gromov, who's not here. I think I will try not to talk much on it, since I definitely believe that you must have heard talks by Pedro, by Amit, by Kolya. Yet let me mention one important thing, that when I talk about integrability calculation of three-point functions, I do not mean that this formula by Pedro, Amit, and Kolya, and Jorge is a kind of independent knowledge. I treat it everywhere, as was supposed in these works, as rather an integrability-based resummation technique, which is especially helpful when it comes to operators with a high number of excitations. So in this sense, technically, one can say that still, that since I in particular work with not really great numbers of magnons, so I have in part one and part two 6 magnons, and part three I have 8 magnons, there is no reason to treat it with integrability. And the answer is, of course, there is no reason per se. Yet there is one important reason to check and to test further the integrability assisted resummation, which is not that easy to apply if you are not one of the authors of for example, of this paper or the three preceding papers. And secondly, as I will say a few slides later, the integrability assisted techniques in calculating three-point functions at the level of one loop are based on this theta morphism conjecture, which needs to see, let's say, some experimental evidence. So I hope this will contribute as one particular example. Well, when you mean when we say that, for example, that your norm is all loop norm. Yeah. So by doing these calculations loop by loop, we want to see where well, if it's extendable into all possible loops, or it will, I don't know, break two, three loops, and so on. Yes, and it's also so apart from that, it's also a test of more mundane, more down-to-earth things like possible misprints, miscalculations, just technical errors, since there haven't been many tests of your formula that you wrote with Kohler, right? I mean, the one-loop formula. So in this sense, I believe the tests are still important and still necessary. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, resummation maybe is not a good word. Basically, what I mean is that when you calculate the scalar product of beta states in this integrability technique by Pedro et al., you save a lot of calculational effort by working with better vectors and not, for example, with operators in coordinate bases in Young-Mills. Yeah. So this word resummation just means you are in the proper representation, yes, which is better representation, and you have some nice formulae, nice, very compact formula compared to perturbation theory, allowing you to do with less effort the scalar products. Well, it's not, no. The resummation is just a bad word. Forget it. Yeah. So call it summation if you want. Because you can, in principle, just write out explicitly all the wave functions and go on summing. And here it's all in a very, all written down in a very compact manner. Yeah. Yeah. So let me just point out another important thing for understanding how this works, how the comparison works, since I definitely have here two weakly coupled approaches, perturbation theory and integrability formula from Pedro and Kohler. The remaining side, which is string hill theory, is certainly strongly coupled. Yet, we all know this this nice and even trivial argument that when you go to Frolov-Zeitlin limit, that is when you still have a large lambda, yet even larger J squared, where J is your R charge, you can organize expansion in lambda prime, which can be made small, and therefore can be made expansion parameter, both on the weakly coupled side and on the strongly coupled side. So therefore, this comparison is legal, although it raises a lot of discussion, which I'm not going to cover here, since it's a very in-depth discussion of whether this equivalence of something against something in Frolov-Zeitlin limit is trivial or not. This I would leave beyond the scope, so I'll just try to do some research in whether things do coincide or do not coincide. So basically, we start with just simple BMN operators. Forgive me not for writing here this ugly trace part. And I work with the symmetric sector for simplicity. So I'll be looking for this correlator and look and we'll try to compare it to string field theory, where an effective vertex of for interaction of such BMN excitations has been known since long ago. And before I proceed, I must mention three very important obstacles, which in the general case do make really a mess of a calculation. So one should be careful about the type of the operators we consider and the type of the limit we're in to avoid these complications or to find some calculational way out of them. When you calculate the three-point functions, you're supposed, well, three-point functions at next Lydian order, you're supposed to be to use the properly defined basis of BMN states. And this properly defined basis is subject to admixture of double trace states, which is also a very ancient story. It's more than it has been known for more than a decade. To operators from different sectors, and you can also mix operators with different momenta. So concerning the mixing of operators of single trace operators with double trace operators, which can look, for example, like this, one should notice that it is indeed absolutely important in case of so-called extremal correlators. So an extremal correlator is such where at least for one of these objects, which are one of these numbers, which are the numbers of the propagators between operator I and operator j, is zero. Then, as shown quite long ago, the three-point correlator is sensitive to double trace corrections even in the leading order. So if you just calculate it without the double trace part, you get a wrong answer. And since on the integrability side, for example, we do not know anything of the multiple trace operators, it's more than reasonable to exclude such examples from our considerations. So therefore, we just choose a sector of non-extremal correlators. This can be done by various means, either by choosing operators in the, choosing three magnon operators in the SU2, in the SO6 sector, or choose properties of 4 magnons, 2 magnons, and 2 magnons in the SU2 sectors, but no extremal correlators. They can be also interested, but then, of course, we don't have a counterpart to compare on the integrability side. So then you can, in principle, look into the diagonalization of operators within the same sector, which are mixed with magnons of different momenta. So I think this was derived by Bizert in 2004 or even earlier. The argument that we don't have to take such terms into account is simple. You make an estimate of how much these matrix elements contribute in the large R charge limit, and you see that they happily go to zero in the leading R charge approximation at given order of coupling constant. So away with these guys, and as well we can do away with mixing of, let's say, scalar symmetric BMN with some fermionic operators. Again, if you want to be exact, or if you want to go in 1 over j, one order further, you have to take these things into account. I think this was calculated by Russo. Yeah, by Giorgio Gili and Russo. But we work in the in each of the orders in the coupling constant, we work in the leading 1 over j order, so we can forget about these. Yeah. So that was some necessary disclaimer about what we do and what we do not do in perturbative field theory. And concerning the string field theory calculation, first of all, let me remind what is meant in this context by string field theory. If you take the PP wave limit, you can write down the effective Hamiltonian of string mode of string oscillation modes interaction. This was done years ago by Spradlin, Valovich, Schwartz, then Dabashi and Nea, by some other people. And there is a way how you identify these oscillations just in a very direct fashion with BMN operators. So in some way, this string field theory part of the calculation is much simpler than direct perturbative count, since everything you need is just one effective. So everything you need is effective quantum mechanics, the Hamiltonian of which is known in the leading 1 over n order to all orders in lambda prime. So therefore, instead of doing some technically complicated calculations in perturbative field theory, you just write out the necessary matrix element of this effective Hamiltonian, and together, so combine it with some prefactor consisting of the dimensions of the corresponding operators, their R charges. So this is the matrix element, right? I'm showing it in a minute. And do a Taylor decomposition, which is much cheaper than do any Feynman diagrams by hand. So here I'm writing out the this effective string field theory Hamiltonian. It has these bilinears of BMN operators in the exponent taken with these Neumann matrices, which can be found out in the literature. And it has also quite simplistic prefactor, where you have to remember that you sum only over the positive modes. This was basically the upgrade of this technique done by Dabashi and Junay in 2004. And then you're done. So basically, you have just to dwell on matrix elements of this Hamiltonian. I'm not going to show the technicality. The technicalities. Let me just show the results. Here is the leading order and the subleading order term for the string theory calculation, which comes just from basically from taking these three Neumann matrices and the corresponding prefactor in front of them. So we have a nice corresponding of so we have a nice decomposition of the or the structure coefficient of these three BMN operators. Yes, and there is something I think I have swallowed up, so let me pronounce it once more. Here, the operators, so these indices in the Neumann matrices 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 1 correspond to each of the respective operators we're dealing with. And what is important, they were taken in the full SO6 sector, so that we explicitly deal with a non-extremal correlator, where basically every operator is convoluted at least once with every other one. So now to perturbative calculation. This was done, although there are such beautiful mathematical ways as the magic formula by Kohler, Pedro, Amit, and Jorge. This was on purpose done by the most archaic method available, just to be sure everything is working okay, and it is indeed working okay. So it was just evaluation of these diagrams. So the circles are Z and Z bar, and the squares are extra phi fields. So you see that the phi's inserted were not just phi 1, but phi 2 and phi 3, so that we cover the whole scalar subsector. And then, just by doing some trivial manipulations with these wave functions and the Feynman diagrams, we get the leading order, which corresponds to strings. And so these are the Feynman diagrams for subleading orders. They run at high powers in J, and then which then cancel nicely, and finally we have the result of correct order in J, and which is more important, which completely corresponds to the results of the string field theory. This has been say the first part of the story. So let me fix this result for the moment. It's nice that two things converged, yet one wouldn't say that something else was really being expected. So let me now proceed to the more modern way of thinking about the three-point functions, since, as I said, both the string field theory technique has been here for a decade, and the direct perturbation theory calculation of three-point functions has been known for a decade. So actually, the first part of this work could have been written in, I think, like 2003. 10 years ago. So it wasn't written for some reasons, so now we have closed the gap, but there is yet nothing to be very enthusiastic about. So let's go to newer things. And this is the picture that I'm totally sure all of you have seen many times. And let me just repeat once more for non-experts in the audience that the integrability formula for a three-point function is not some new knowledge coming directly from the from high above, or not some new revelation, but is rather at this stage an improvement of our perturbative techniques. Yet it is an improvement that has all possible ways of going much further to higher loops and even to the all loop answers. So, so let Pedro correct me, but I think we all believe that finally the three-point correlative formula will, like we have it for the two-point functions with Bayesian Tedenstow, Dirac-Lebesgue answers, will encompass the all loop also for the correlator. So now we have, now actually just one part of this three-point function correlation function formula is kind of supposed to work for all loops, which is the norm. But we'll see, and that's precisely why we are on the way of doing these tests. So I guess I can go very briefly through the slides describing the idea behind this integrability related formula for three-point functions. The idea is the following. We have three states. And the states are described by rapidities U, V, and W. So these are some sets of rapidities which carry information about the momentum of the magnons and about the sectors where the magnons live. The idea is to not to work with coordinate representation for these chains where you can pair each separate site of the chain to each separate site of the chain, but work with magnons as you would with a momentum representation just in normal field theory, and you pair not site to site, but a magnon to a magnon. So this this is the most in the easiest way understood when you think of having a scalar product of two magnons, and this for sure is related to two-point functions. So how does the three-point function calculation work? You split all of these sets of magnons, so each of these sets of magnons into two subsets, and then you pair each of the subsets with another one. So you pair subset one of U with subset two of W, subset one of W with subset two of V, and subset one of V with subset two of U. And therefore, the result for the three-point function consists. The three-point function has the most important, most non-trivial piece, consisting of the three scalar product, well here denoted as suggested by the authors as the part that shows the tailored pieces of the magnon vectors. Yes, and there are several auxiliary factors which basically tell us, which take into account the norms of the states and take into account the fact that you have to conjugate the states in a bit peculiar fashion, and you have to, so when you do these combinations of magnons, you have to move them through each respective chain, therefore you get some phases. But the most important piece here is, of course, how you do the scalar product. Here is written in a more legible legible way. Basically, I think I can skip these technicalities just because you must have seen them a million times. I proceed to where some conjectural part in this calculation begins. So as I said, the formula suggested by Escobedo, Sever, Gromov, and Vieira was valid only in the SU2 sector. And this is, well, it's great that we have a formula for SU2 sector, yet since we know very well, very explicitly, how to write down the beta ansatz for the whole n equals 4, it would be nice to go one step further. So the part which has these non-trivial contributions depending on the sector you, you choose, this part containing the scalar products, so when you deal with the SU2 sector, basically the information about which kind of beta ansatz you are solving is passed to all these formula, so to the phase factors, or the card factors, and to the scalar products by means of these two factors, you may call them form factors or whatever else, the F and G. Actually, they are known already in a couple of different sectors like SL2 and SU11. And basically, they pass the information about the particular sector we're working with. So, as it is common integrability here, what is suggested here is not a derivation, but rather a guess. So this guess consists in finding a suitable replacement for this F and G factors that, as already has been successful for SU2, SU11, and SL2, would pass on the information from a different sector. So, and here is the basically the conjecture, which has not yet been derived directly. Yet I think there is a good reason to take it as a basis for comparison, since first of all, it's consistent with the conjecture for the norm that is that also was given in the work by Vieira and Gromov for arbitrary sector, and by the way, an arbitrary loop. Second, it naturally, so since you can represent the S matrix of the theory by F of UV divided over F it's kind of natural answers you would look for in such a case. So therefore, we choose this as our working conjecture, and moreover, from having these plausibility arguments, we check by direct calculation if this can be used or if it just yields some rubbish in the end. So again, I'm not going to stop on the technicalities. Just let me tell you that for the reasons that the original formula is not well defined, if one of these sectors, one of these factors, namely G, is equal to zero, we have to go one step backwards and use for our purposes the a recurrent formula for scalar product of beta states, which doesn't have any singularities in G's. So where this idea, this conjectured structure for the scalar product, can be implemented just by direct replacement of F and G factors to what we suppose. So when we implement all that with our operators represented here by in beta notations by these beta vectors, so we have six magnons carrying momenta, and these guys have also two excitations in the highest sectors. And basically, due to these excitations, we avoid being in the extremal case. But it's exactly because of these excitations we have to consider the SO6 case. So, and the final answer is that yes, this works. So we do get exactly the same result, which is of course not a proof, since it's just one particular choice of operators, where it was very important that we know how to couple magnons from, let's say, sector 2 to sector 3. Magnons with sector, well, by these 1, 2, and 3, I mean the nodes of Dynkin diagram. So when we were in the SU2 sector, we were sitting on the central node, and here we have extended our set of states to the states that live also on the first node and on the third node, right? And therefore, when we consider all possible convolutions of these, of subsets of magnons from here to here and from here to here, we must know how to convolute two with three and two with one, for example. And up to now, this has worked. And in the third part, well, I mean that the leading order result is the same as in perturbation theory, which we calculated completely independently. Just let's return here. We checked these six magnons. So each of them has example, momentum n1 and minus n1, n2 and minus n2, n3 and minus n3. So for all, and we have an explicit expression depending on all of these momenta, on R charge, on well, I am studying SU3, since this is a state that you cannot that you do not describe in SU2, anyway, the momentum, so we have just one momentum carrying node, right? So the momentum carrying node has some momenta, and these guys this is the solution. You can have different solutions where instead of zero, you have something else. I don't know, 1/√3 or some other number. But this, as you know better than me, this number doesn't carry momentum. So technically, when you look at such a state, and when you want to do a scalar product of, let's say, this, take the substate. So this excitation and this excitation convoluted with O3, right? When you try to do that without knowing the SO6 formula, you just have nothing at hand. Right. So, and now I come to something which will pose a problem at the end. It may be of different origin, yet let's go on towards it. Here I do a comparison which looks also a bit trivial. So I take the formula derived by Pedro and Kohler for the three-point function of SU2 operators at one loop and compare it to string field theory, also at next leading order in Frolov-Tatel limit in lambda prime decomposition. And I'm going to have problems. So what kind of operators do we consider here? I have instead of six magnons, I have eight momentum carrying particles. So I have operator O1 with two magnons, O2 with four magnons. So unlike the previous case where the extra magnons were in the highest sectors and therefore were not carrying momentum, these guys are carrying momentum. So they all will contribute as dynamical variables to the final answer. And this third guy has two momenta. And since I'm running already of time, it's nice I don't have many technical things here. Anyway, I wouldn't be able to talk on them. So let me just give a very short sketch of how the result looks like. Because, well, if I try to explain all the details of how you do the theta morphism, how you calculate the norms at one loop, if that is extendable to all loops, how you calculate the scalar products of magnons at higher loops, this would have taken eternity. So the answer basically is organized as some complicated factor coming from a scalar product of the first and second operator. Then there is some factor coming purely from the third operator, and the whole thing is divided over the norms. And well, take it as a recipe. So when I apply this recipe to the state, so the states I have just described, states with four magnons, with eight magnons, I get explicit results for the leading order and sub-leading order terms in the structure constant. And I think I should have written here an N, the large N, which I have omitted. Sorry about that. Okay. So just let these expressions remain, and we'll see what comes out from the string field theory calculation. So the string field theory calculation works quite in the same way as was done in the first part of the talk. So there are some pre-factors depending on the dimensions of the operators, deltas, and there is some non-trivial part of the calculation, which is the matrix element of the effective Hamiltonian. So the effective Hamiltonian consists of a pre-factor and an exponential with Neumann matrix. So basically, to calculate the string field theory result, again, you just extract, in this case, not three, but four Neumann matrices. since we're in the 8 Magnon sector. And the matrix element looks somehow like this. Well, then you have to take into account that you can replace N1 by N2. You can replace minus N1 by N1. So take all the possible symmetries of this expression into account. And then you also obtain by direct perturbative expansion. So without all these complicated complications of either theory, where you have to do diagrams, or integrability, where you have to learn theta morphisms, you have to learn the all loop norms and all things like this. So here, until you're in the one in the leading order in 1/n, you just do the lambda prime expansion. And the statement is that by now, since well, this is actually an ongoing research, but by now I'm kind of sure that given these methods and this way of thinking, this is the correct statement. These objects do agree at leading order in lambda prime, but disagree in the sub-leading order in lambda prime. And I think this is a place where we have to stop and to look at this discrepancy as to consider what it brings into our understanding of let's say, of the relationship between string field theory, perturbation theory, and integrability. Since in the history of, let's say, two-point sector of the n equals 4 integrability, there have been several cases of some discrepancies that either have come out to be superficial or to be a result of someone's error, which for some reason no one was able to detect for some time, or in other cases, the discrepancies that one has observed in integrability versus string theory or versus field theory correspondence have contributed greatly to our understanding of the structure of the duality. Let's remember, for example, the story about the dressing phase and so on. So here, a question mark must be put. So I don't have an answer. If it is a problem intrinsic to operator redefinition, a problem with, let's say, authors' capability in doing theta morphism and applying Pedro's formula properly. This also can be, but I don't think it's exactly the case here. Or which is perhaps the most reasonable conjecture by now is that for some reason there is a problem in how one identifies operators on the string side and on the integrability. Say it again? This is well, this is also an answer. This is
the correct one, no?
Hmm?
It's the correct one. Why do you expect a match at all? As you explained in the introduction, there's already this one computation is strong coupling, one is weak coupling. There's no reason for them to match.
Well, but don't forget we have the Frolov-Zeitlin limit.
Who cares? I mean, a priori, you cannot expand a function at strong coupling and then take J large and expect a match. A priori, they should not match. If they match, okay, they match. And then you can explain why they match. But if they don't match, and furthermore, you already said in the introduction that for some correlation functions at one loop, it is known.
Yes, for example, like giant graviton, simple graviton, this calculation.
It's not single trace, but for single trace, every light operator.
Mm-hmm.
You can compute explicitly, analytically, at strong coupling, analytically at weak coupling, and see that, okay, the two results are not the same. So why should they be the same for your case? They should not.
Yeah. So.
I don't think that you have a weak coupling result and a strong coupling result, and they are different.
So you. So basically, your argument is that. Is that of, let's say, non-commutativity of the limits, right?
Yeah, but that is the argument. This is what mm-hmm. is understood, that in mm-hmm. general, these limits do not commute
mm-hmm.
a priori. Sometimes you understand why they commute. For example, because say, in classical limit, you have in both cases some kind of finite gap description, and you can really look at it and see that the two are the same, or you can explain that the string action becomes a Landau-Lifshitz sigma model that
right.
is describing mm-hmm. HD. You have some reason, technical reason, to explain why the two results agree. But mm-hmm. a priori, why would weak coupling and strong coupling give the same result?
Well, I would put it like this. So for sure, you're right that there is different order of limits, and no one expects the limits to commute. One would be happy to see they do, but if they don't, let it just be stated.
Yeah, but mm-hmm. I just want to say that it's not a problem.
Okay, actually, I can easily adopt that point of view. Okay. Yeah. So, and I think basically that's all. So I guess that it's still fun to do calculations on different sides, whether we do expect or don't expect, they match. It's just fun.
Let me just make a comment about SO6.
Mm-hmm.
You check the case when J is very large, right?
Right.
You check that it's, so when J is large, you are studying the leading order in this BMN limit, where the way the particles scatter is not important. The momentum of the particles is very small. The mm-hmm. repeats are very large. And mm-hmm. all the terms like S matrices and so on can be set to one. So you don't probe most of your expression, of your conjecture, by studying this limit. So I would say that it is a priori, by considering this large J limit, you are really throwing away
most of the dynamics.
F, for example, mm-hmm. that you said, it's 1 plus Cartan matrix mm-hmm. over mm-hmm. U minus V. But you will not see this Cartan matrix at all, because you'll be taking the limit where the roots are very large. So you will not be seeing it. So many of the elements that you say you are generalizing by putting these elements in SO6, if you study only this large J limit, you will not see them. So I would say that it would be nice to take some explicit states at some finite size and compare the norm and so on. I don't think there is a... It is so hard to just create states explicitly for SO6, for some chains of, say, length 8 or 10, and just check whether the conjecture is true or not, because a priori it is not such a complicated computation that
it is not.
Such things should
Certainly
remain at
not.
The level of a conjecture when it can be checked yeah. correctly very easily.
Yeah. Thank you for the very nice suggestion. It's actually something we keep thinking on since, basically we would like to have, if not a derivation yet, a crucial test where we would be sure that, this is beyond reasonable doubt. We have taken a very generic example, and an example where this scalar product is indeed important. So thank you very much for the suggestion.
Maybe you could ask João. He played a bit with your phone. Uh-huh. After the time.
So you're saying that there's a non-trivial SU2 embedding what they're doing.
No, I'm just saying that what is the BMN limit? The BMN limit is the limit where the chains are huge.
Right.
And then you just have a bunch of plane waves of particles that don't interact with each other. So then roughly your correlation function are just, you just have a bunch of plane waves, you ignore the region of the wave function when they are closed, and you do your combinatorics with this approximation. But all these integrability approaches are developed exactly to go beyond this very dilute limit and study the interactions of the particles and the interesting details of the wave function that is crucial if you want to go beyond the very, very dilute limit. So if you want really to have something that is more related to integrability and to the scattering and to Bittanzatz and so on, you better go significantly away from BMN, because BMN only checks that you have a bunch of plane waves.
Mm-hmm.
You have a bunch of plane waves at strong coupling, also at weak coupling. Then technically the computations are very similar, and that is why you have matches.
Yeah. Okay.
don't know what's not Andrea again.